and unbalanced in our work practices. Idols of control take several forms, including intense worry, lack of trust, and micromanagement. While we are usually blind to our own idols, it is not very hard to see them in others, and to see how others counterfeit God's fill them with anxiety, anger, and discouragement. So, the concept of individual idols is not too hard for us to grasp. However, idols are not only the basis for personal sins and problems. They are also the basis for collective ones. When an individual makes and serves an idol, it creates psychological distortion and trouble. When a family, group, or country makes and serves an idol, it creates social and cultural trouble. To understand this concept of cultural or corporate idols, in the sense of a group of people, not in the sense of a business structure, we must begin with a more precise description of culture than we used in Chapter 3. Columbia University professor Andrew DelBanco writes, "I will use the word culture to mean the stories and symbols by which we try to hold back the melancholy suspicion that we live in a world without meaning. Any history of hope in America must therefore make room at its center for this dogged companion of hope, the lurking suspicion that all our getting and spending amounts to nothing more than fidgeting while we wait for death. All cultures have this need for contact with what William James called the ideal power, through which that feeling of being in a wider life than that of this world's little interests may be reached." Every culture has a set of answers to the questions addressed in the book of Ecclesiastes. Questions such as, what are we here to accomplish in our life? What are we getting, spending, and living for? Without some answers to these big questions, it is impossible to live and make decisions, and every culture is at some level based on a set of shared beliefs about how to answer these questions. So while each individual needs to live for something, so does each society. Or, put another way, every society puts before its members some ideas or values that it says will give life meaning. Friedrich Nietzsche concurred that every society offers up ideals to its members. Ancient cultures called people to live for God, or the gods, for family and tribe or nation. Modern societies turned away from the authorities of religion and tradition and replaced them with the authorities of reason and individual freedom. Nietzsche was looking mainly at modern cultures, but he observed that all cultures, even self-styled secular ones, promote moral absolutes and transcendent values to which, they said, all people must conform if they are to have worth or meaning. These cultural ideals are truly idols in the biblical sense. They are not commended as simply good ideas. Rather, they are treated as holy and unassailable, and promoted with religious fervor and passion. They are said to bestow happiness and fulfillment, earthly forms of salvation. All people are obliged to serve these idols, and those who despise them are themselves to be rejected. So while ancient cultures ostracized anyone who disbelieved in the gods, modern culture castigates anyone who is thought guilty of bigotry or appears to be an enemy of equality and individual freedom. If every culture has its idols, how do they influence how we do our work? Keeping in mind that an idol is a good thing turned into an ultimate thing, then a corporate idol is an overemphasis and absolutizing of an admirable cultural trait. We should expect, then, that each culture's emphases have some beneficial influences on work and yet at the same time harmfully distort it. Christians seeking to work faithfully and well must discern the shape of the idols functioning in their professional industries so as to both affirm the beneficial aspects and offset the excesses and distortions. So what kinds of corporate and cultural idols are there? Keeping in mind the inevitability of overgeneralization in such a brief treatment, I will provide an overview of the prevailing idols of the three dominant cultures of Western history: traditional, modern, and postmodern. In nearly every field of work, You will encounter a mixture of these sets of cultural idols because they will have influenced the founders, heroes, leaders, and innovators of the dominant institutions in diverse ways over the course of generations. Idols of traditional cultures. As we just mentioned, traditional cultures in the past and present understand the world to contain moral absolutes that are known mainly through tradition and religion. Wisdom is passed down from one generation to the next through figures of authority such as parents, priests, and rulers. Such cultures teach their members that their lives have meaning if they assume and are faithful to their duties and roles within the community. As sons and daughters, as fathers and mothers, and as members of their tribe and nation. In such cultures, family, race, and nation can become dangerously paramount. This is the basis for honor killings in such cultures, where some members of a family kill a member perceived to bring dishonor to the clan. This elevation of family in traditional cultures often results in minimal support and recourse to the victims of spousal and child abuse. This also helps us understand why Japanese soldiers in World War II despised Allied prisoners of war who, they reasoned, had put their own individual lives ahead of the nation by not fighting to the death. All of these practices seem almost impossible to understand for those of us in contemporary Western societies. Nonetheless, in Western societies, we have still struggled mightily with the idols of race and racism. American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr understood that the tendency to privilege the interests of one's own tribe or nation over others is due to the cosmic insecurity of our sinful hearts. This insecurity fixes on race to bolster our sense of value. We see differences between our own culture and those of others in highly moralistic terms. We look down on other races so we can think of ourselves as superior. This idol can easily grow into something very cruel. As a result, it is possible to make national security, or cultural and racial purity, into an end in itself, justifying militarism and domestic oppression, or at least indifference to the plight of minorities. The idolatries of more traditional places and cultures also affect our work. The idol of race can mean that many businesses are closed to people and ideas from culturally and racially different backgrounds, to the overall detriment of the company's competitiveness and the community's health. The idol of nationalism, of course, has led industrialists to support militaristic programs that seemed patriotic at the time, but in hindsight ruined their reputation for all time. Traditional cultures make idols out of social stability and the good of the whole over the rights of the individual. This has a major impact on business practices. In Japan, still largely a traditional culture, it has not been acceptable either for workers to move from company to company in order to find a better salary, or for companies to lay workers off to sustain profits. Until the turn of this century, the Japanese ideal had been lifelong employment. Employees were expected to stay with the same company their entire lives. In a traditional culture, the profit motive of business is accompanied by a strong social obligation to provide jobs for people. Employees are less concerned with their own pay than with the status and reputation of the company where they are employed. There are certainly some benefits to this emphasis on loyalty and social stability. However, it can also lead to exploitation of workers, who are often stigmatized if they make what Western cultures would see as just demands for increased salary and benefits. It can also lead to economic devastation during economic downturns. A New York Times article during the 1992 recession, "No Layoff Ideal Costs Japan Dearly," explained how during downturns, U.S. companies are able to more quickly recover financial health and therefore provide jobs for more people in the long run by reducing staff. The Japanese ideal led to many companies completely collapsing and doing even more damage to people's lives because their culture did not feel free to make the hard call of layoffs. Idols of Modern Cultures. Great changes occurred in Western societies approximately 500 years ago. With the rise of modern science and the philosophical movement called the Enlightenment, modern society dethroned the idols of religion, tribe, and tradition, replacing them with reason, empiricism, and individual freedom as the ultimate values that overrule all others. The modern value of reason includes several elements. One is the ideal of progress, embodied in the unstoppable forward march of science and technology. Modern societies adopted the conviction that the diffusion of science and technology would bring happier days, and that history and politics must be shaped by this ideal. It was said that science alone has a rigorous, empirical method that results in proof, not merely speculation or feeling. Also, in the modern worldview, absolutely everything has a natural and therefore physical cause. At the popular level, this view still has enormous cultural authority. Most people do not venture to make a case in the public square without relying on scientific evidence, which is seen as objective and unassailable. The implicit idea is that science, given enough time, will be able to answer all questions and solve all problems. Scientific methods have extended beyond the physical and social sciences into the realms of marketing, political entertainment. Modern culture stopped looking to the wisdom of the ancients or to any revelation from religious authorities except for optional private spiritual comfort. To build a flourishing society, we need only human reason informed by the scientific method. Closely related to this radical new hope in human reason was the absolutizing of individual freedom. Modern societies no longer saw the world as containing binding moral norms of truth to which all people must submit. Rather, they insisted that there was no standard higher than the right of the individual to choose the life he or she wanted to live. The only moral wrong in this view was to keep other individuals from choosing to live as they found fulfilling. That meant that, ultimately, there was no moral authority or cause higher than the happiness of the self. As many have pointed out, this made choice and feelings into something sacred and holy. In the modern world, now the individual was the center of the universe, and the creature beyond all else entitled to absolute respect. In other words, the human self had replaced God. The idols of modern culture have had a profound influence on the shape of our work today. In traditional societies, people found their meaning and sense of value by submitting their interests and sacrificing their desires to serve higher causes like God, family, and other people. In modern societies, there is often no higher cause than individual interests and desires. This shift powerfully changed the role of work in people's lives and now became the way we defined ourselves. Traditional cultures tended to see people's place on the social ladder as assigned by nature or convention, each family having its proper place. That view had put too little stock in the role of individual talent, ambition, and hard work for determining the outcome of one's life. But modern society responded by putting too much stock in the autonomous person. Philosopher Luc Ferry explains how the new individualism of modern society influenced our work. In the aristocratic traditional worldview, work was considered a defect, a servile activity, literally reserved for slaves. In the modern worldview, it becomes an arena for self-realization, a means not only of educating oneself, but also of fulfillment. Work becomes the defining activity of man. His aim is to create himself by remaking the world. So, the modern idol of individualism has tended to raise work from being a good thing to being nearly a form of salvation. At the same time, the modern idols of reason and empiricism intensified the work experience by creating a pressure for higher production than had ever been applied before. Near the end of the 19th century, Frederick Taylor developed scientific management, which was called the rationalization of production. It was the intense application of scientific methods to business processes to generate maximum efficiency. At the time, laborers in the factories taken over by Taylor's methods reacted with fury. They felt dehumanized, since all personal discretion and initiative was taken out of their hands and driven like slaves. Taylor's system valued every task being simplified, standardized, and executed with absolute uniformity every time. As many have pointed out, this is how machines work. Peter Drucker, the foremost critic of Taylor's approach, argued that the extreme rationalization of work did indeed treat human beings like cogs in a mechanism. Machines, he wrote, work best if they do only one task, if they do it repetitively, and if they do the simplest possible task. But the human being is a very poorly designed machine tool. The human being excels in coordination. He excels in relating perception to action. He works best if the entire human being, muscles, senses, and mind, is engaged in the work. Is the influence of modern idols positive for our work today? The answer is somewhat yes, but ultimately no. Modern idols bestowed greater dignity on some kinds of work than had existed in ancient cultures, but in this sense it came closer to the high regard the Bible has for labor, but it overshot the mark in many ways. We are far more efficient and productive than we used to be, but this progress has come at a great cost. My own grandfather's experience was a good case study of the mixture of good and evil brought to the realm of work in the modern age. Born in Italy in 1880 into a traditional culture and a family of potters, he told his father that he didn't want to follow in his career footsteps. He was told that it would be impossible in that stratified society to get another job or even move to another village. In response, he emigrated to America in 1897, a far more modern society allowing a social mobility unthinkable in his homeland. There he began to work on the subways, under New York City, under grueling conditions that demanded high productivity but provided no safety, a situation that would not have happened to him in his own village. After almost losing a leg in a work accident, he moved to Wilmington, Delaware, where, through his ability to start his own butcher shop, which also would have been unlikely in his own village, he established himself in his new country. Within his lifetime, he was liberated, dashed, and rehabilitated by the effects of modern culture. Idols of Postmodern Cultures. Beginning with the writings of the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, in the latter half of the 19th century, a new cultural shift began to occur in Western societies. Long before the horrors of the world wars, Nietzsche declared that the idea that science will lead to inevitable human progress was an idol, a new quasi-religious faith, and that it had no grounding in reality. Science can tell us only what is, never how things ought to be. Human beings are capable of kindness and unselfishness, but also of cruelty and violence, and science will simply serve the interests of whoever is in power. There is no particular reason, he pointed out, to think science will somehow lead us to a better world. It could just as easily lead us into a bleak future, through armed conflict, or an ecological disaster, or the rise of tyrants who use technology for powerful social control. Nietzsche struck a blow not only to the modern idol of reason and science, but also to the new modern morality of individual rights and freedom. With great force, he pointed out the deep inconsistency of the modern view. Modern culture tells us there are no moral absolutes, and everyone must choose his or her own standard for right and wrong. Yet, it then turns and says we must respect human rights and honor the freedom and dignity of every human being. But on what basis? Nietzsche would ask. If there are no moral absolutes, then how can you arbitrarily declare that there are? If human beings are simply the product of the same natural processes that formed rust and rocks, why does every person deserve to be treated with equality and dignity? Though Nietzsche's arguments were deeply disturbing, his basic points were very telling. And in so many ways, the disasters and atrocities of the 20th century only seemed to bear them out. As a result, despite the fact that in Western society there is still a strong, latent influence from traditional world views such as Christianity, along with much of the older modern optimism about science, progress, and human freedom, there has been a pervasive shift called the postmodern turn. It is more a mood than a coherent set of beliefs. There is far more cynicism about all truth claims and plans for society, both older traditional ones and more modern liberal ones. Movies and novels about the future in the mid-20th century often depicted a human society filled with unceasing progress in health, education, scientific knowledge, and social harmony. Today, nearly all movies and novels are far more pessimistic and narrate all sorts of dystopian outcomes. Despite Nietzsche's program to rid the culture of idols, many have pointed out that ultimately postmodern thought makes an idol out of reality as it is. Writers such as Edward Docks, in his article Postmodernism is Dead, lays out this criticism well. He points out that if all moral claims are really just power plays and the product of one social and cultural location, as postmodern theorists argue, then it becomes impossible to critique any condition in the society. No one has an ability to mount a program of reform or denounce injustice. Postmodernism enshrines the present reality, then, as an absolute. The most prominent critic of Nietzsche and the results of postmodernism was the German philosopher Martin Heidegger. He identified the idol of our culture today when he called us the world of technology. Luc Ferry explains Heidegger's point. Before all else, technique concerns means and not ends. Instead of being inspired by transcendental ideas, the modern economy functions like Darwinian natural selection. No one today can be reasonably convinced that this teeming and disruptive evolutionary impulse leads infallibly to what is better. For the first time in the history of life, a living species holds the means to destroy the entire planet, and this species does not know where it is going. Heidegger, Docks, and others such as Jacques Ellul are saying that technology, uncertainty, and the market have become the idols of a postmodern society. Because in postmodern society no one is sure or can agree about ends or goals for the human race, we now have only means or techniques. Since there is no longer any dominant vision of healthy human life or good human society, we are left with nothing but individual competition for personal success and power. If something can be done through technology, it will be done, because our technology has no higher ideals or moral values to guide it or limit it. The resulting fragmentation of society caused by the postmodern turn is itself a pervasive topic of debate in the academy. Both Robert Bella and Andrew DelBunco argue the case that any cohesive society needs to give individuals something bigger and greater than themselves to live for. DelBunco argues that, ironically, the heyday of the New Left in the 1960s and of the New Right in the 1980s cooperated in instilling instant gratification as the hallmark of the good life. What was lost was any conception of a common destiny worth tears, sacrifice, and maybe even death. DelBunco agrees with others who say that in the end, postmodern idols cause individuals to become dupes of advertisers, falling into unconscious conformity with other interchangeable products of the marketplace. Many writers argue convincingly that the values of the market, consumerism and cost-benefit efficiencies, are now spreading into every part of life, even family life. This is because modern capitalism is no longer simply a useful instrument for the distribution of goods and services, but has become a near absolute idol. And even in the most successful capitalist societies, like that of the United States, many recognize the cultural contradiction that consumerism tends to undermine the very virtues of self-control and responsibility on which capitalism is founded. How does this shift of mood and meaning affect our work now? I spoke to a man, now in his 80s, who was one of the pioneers of the hedge fund industry. He told me that in the late 1950s and most of the 1960s, the great majority of the best and the brightest did not want to go into financial services. They wanted to go into education and science. They wanted to teach the young, put people on the moon, and solve world hunger. And the leading voices of the day told them they could do it. At some point in the late 1980s, he sensed a change in society. There was far less optimism about social progress, or even how to define it. People were divided by the culture wars. Cynicism set in, and over time the most ambitious and talented people wanted to go into business and finance. The perception was that unless you were a highly paid professional, you could not live a fulfilled, free life. "It's not healthy," he told me. And he was right. He was agreeing with the analyses of the philosophers and scholars, but rather than observing an ideological trend, he saw how the shift played out concretely in young adults' career choices. He was old enough to see the shift from a largely modern to a more postmodern understanding of work. The most obvious effect of the postmodern means without an end idolatry, at the time of this writing, is the widespread deception, fraud, and self-interested actions of financial companies, revealed in the recession of 2008 and its aftermath. Naomi Wolf, writing in the British daily newspaper The Guardian, reviewed what could be seen just in the newspaper headlines of June and July 2012. She goes down the list. Barclays Bank and others colluding to manipulate interest rates. The HSBC banking group fined $1 billion for not preventing money laundering, a highly profitable activity not to prevent, between 2004 and 2010. $215 million of customer money missing at Peregrine Capital, whose founder faces criminal charges after a suicide attempt. Wells Fargo agreeing to pay $175 million in fines for, again, very lucratively, automatically charging African-American and Hispanic mortgagees costlier rates on their subprime mortgages than white people with identical credit ratings. Bank of America and SunTrust were also fined for the same practice. The 2008 recession itself, of course, was triggered by bankers profiting from the sales of enormous numbers of mortgages that were packaged in ways that concealed their low underlying value. The conclusion of this sad litany was found in the subtitle of Wolf's article. "The media's bad apple thesis no longer works. We're seeing systemic corruption in banking and systemic collusion." Those with more politically liberal sensitivities are quick to perceive the postmodern idols of means without ends in the area of business. They are not as sensitive to the even more pervasive problem that we now get a sense of self not from our roles in family and society, but as consumers. We are encouraged to create a persona through the brands we choose to purchase and the identity we are able to construct for ourselves online. This phenomenon has an especially profound impact on the fields of media, entertainment, and marketing. I have spoken to many of my church members in marketing and advertising about the shift away from advertising the benefits of products in favor of advertising a life story that promises the consumer an enhanced identity and a higher quality of life. Yale philosopher Nicholas Woltersdorf observes that modern culture defines the happy life as a life that is going well, full of experiential pleasure, while to the ancients, the happy life meant a life that is lived well, with character, courage, humility, love, and justice. So all who work in marketing and promotion will be expected to promise people not merely that their products will work satisfactorily, but also that they will bring them happiness. I spoke to a man and woman who both were advertising executives and were thinking of leaving their respective companies. The woman's firm had just 2 major clients, and both were cosmetic companies. The message they want me to send about our products, that this will help you finally find love and love yourself, is toxic. The man worked for an agency with a sports car company for a client. He was under pressure, not for the first time, to market his car as a means to sex appeal. Both workers pushed back and got strong resistance in return. The man kept his job because he changed the message from sex appeal to high-performance vehicle, and did it so skillfully and compellingly that the client and his company were satisfied. The woman, however, did not succeed and had to leave her firm, going into business for herself. Christians agree that when we sell and market, we need to show potential customers that a product adds value to their lives. That doesn't mean it can give them a life. But because Christians have a deeper understanding of human well-being, we will often find ourselves swimming against the very strong currents of the corporate idols of our culture. Finding hope for our work. We have been describing what work was designed to be and what has gone wrong with it. Even if we find ourselves doing the kind of work we want and in the best sorts of work environments, the broken nature of work seems overwhelming. What hope is there for work? How can we put work right? We may ask. How do we look past the deep problems and realize God's purpose and plan? Is that a realistic goal? Or is it just a nice idea that has no bearing on tomorrow's meeting or next year's career change? We can begin to answer these questions only by first settling one sure fact. Nothing will be put perfectly right, as St. Paul says, until the day of Christ at the end of history. See Philippians chapter 1, verse 6 and chapter 3, verse 12. Until then, all creation groans, see Romans chapter 8, verse 22, and is subject to decay and weakness. So work will be put completely right only when heaven is reunited with earth and we find ourselves in our true country. To talk about fully redeeming work is sometimes naivete, sometimes hubris. Yet all is not lost. The transcendent hope depicted so poignantly in Leaf by Nigel, and the ecstatic vision of what creative endeavor will then be like, can go a long way to helping us work with satisfaction within the limits of this world. The Christian gospel decidedly furnishes us with the resources for more inspired, realistic, satisfying, and faithful work today. How? First, the gospel provides an alternate storyline for our work. This is vital because all work is propelled by a worldview or a narrative account of what human life is all about and what will help us thrive. Second, the Christian faith gives us a new and rich conception of work as partnering with God in His love and care for the world. This biblical conception helps us appreciate all work, from the most simple to the most complex, by both believers and non-believers. So Christians who grasp a biblical theology of work learn not only to value and participate in the work of all people, but to also see ways to work distinctively as Christians. Third, the gospel gives us a particularly sensitive new moral compass through a host of sound ethical guidelines to help us make decisions, as well as wise counsel about human hearts. Finally, the gospel radically changes our motives for work and fills us with a new and durable inner power that will be with us through thick and thin. Most books and programs that help people integrate their faith with their work tend to focus on only one or two of these factors. Some, for example, emphasize the first. They take a somewhat academic tack and constitute theological principles into a Christian approach to art, government, economics, and so on. Some concentrate almost completely on the second. They fear that an overemphasis on a biblical worldview and work leads to triumphalism and fails to appreciate God's broad providential activity. Others take a more personal and experiential approach, inviting people to encounter Christ in a new way, and emphasizing the inner power that comes from a gospel-transformed heart. Still others fear that focus on inner heart transformation puts all the weight on personal peace and success, and ignores the social justice implications of the gospel, in which Christians are responsible to serve others through their work. But all of these emphases and concerns are correct. And in the final part of the book, we will seek to show that they are ultimately complementary and very practical. Indeed, one of the reasons the Bible's view of work is so compelling and so helpful in all cultures, social settings, and vocations is because it is so rich and multidimensional. Part 3. The Gospel and Work. Chapter 9. A New Story for Work. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 31. Making sense of the world. People cannot make sense of anything without attaching it to a storyline. After the attacks of September 11, 2001, no one mentioned the event without placing it into some kind of narrative structure. Some said, this is the result of America's abuse of its imperial power in the world. Others said, there are many evil people out there who hate us because we are a good and free country. Depending on which story you believed, you would be associated with the antagonists or the protagonists, and your response, both emotions and actions, would be completely different. A classic illustration of the need for stories comes from philosopher Alistair MacIntyre in his book After Virtue. He asks that you imagine you are standing at a bus stop when a young man you do not know comes up to you and says, the name of the common wild duck is Histrionicus, Histrionicus, Histrionicus. Even though you understand the sentence, his action makes no sense. What does it mean? The only way to make sense of it is to try to learn the story into which this event fits. Perhaps the young man is mentally ill. That would explain it. Or what if yesterday someone of your gender, age, height, and general appearance had approached the young man in the library, asking him the Latin word for the wild duck, and today he had mistaken you for that person? That would explain it, too. Or perhaps the young man is a foreign spy, waiting at a prearranged rendezvous and uttering the ill-chosen code sentence which will identify him to his contact. The first story is sad, the second is comic, and the third is dramatic. But the point is, without a handle on the story, there's no way to understand the meaning of what happened and no way to know how to answer the man. If you call the police when it was a simple case of mistaken identity, it will be very embarrassing. If you pick a fight with someone who is a trained assassin, the result will be even worse. But in any case, if you get the story wrong, your response will be wrong. And if you get the story of the world wrong, if, for example, you see life here as mainly about self-actualization and self-fulfillment rather than the love of God, you will get your life responses wrong, including the way you go about your work. Stories and worldviews. What are the elements of a story? While there are many good scholarly analyses of narrative structure, there is a simple way to put it. A story begins when something knocks life off balance. Then the story progresses, or the plot thickens, as the protagonists struggle to restore that balance and peace, while antagonistic forces block and resist them. Finally, the story ends as the struggle results in either the restoration of balance or the failure to recover it. So for a story to be a story, there must be a problem that makes life not as it ought to be. If we say, Little Red Riding Hood took some food to her grandmother and they ate it together, we might have a charming description, but it is hardly a story, since it has no plot. A story must also have some concept and possibility of things being put right. Little Red Riding Hood was at her grandmother's house, but a wolf broke in and ate them both. A more dramatic set of facts, but again, it's not a story. So a story must have an account of how life should be, an explanation of how it got thrown off balance, and some proposed solution as to what will put life right again. Now, the significance of stories is this. While many stories are often no more than entertainment, narratives are actually so foundational to how we think that they determine how we understand and live life itself. The term worldview, from the German word Weltanschauung, means the comprehensive perspective from which we interpret all of reality. But a worldview is not merely a set of philosophical bullet points. It is essentially a master narrative, a fundamental story about A. what human life in the world should be like, B. what has knocked it off balance, and C. what can be done to make it right. No one can really function in the world without some working answers to those big questions, and so, to provide those answers, we adopt a world story, a narrative that explains things, a world view. Everyone knows that things in this world are seriously out of whack. No one claims that his or her own life is as it should be, let alone the whole world. There is something wrong within us. Nothing ever seems to make us happy or fulfilled except in the most fleeting way. There is also wrong among us. The world is filled with poverty, war, suffering, and injustice. Something seems to have knocked the whole world off balance. But what is it? Who deserves the blame? And what is the solution? As soon as you begin to answer these questions, you arrive at a story that you will begin to live out. We are wired to move through our lives chasing and rehearsing narratives that will promise to bring the world back into balance. McIntyre argues that human actions are enacted narrative. All people are living out some mental world story that gives their lives meaning. That story may be about the struggle of a just cause like saving the environment, or your personal quest to find true love, or to be successful despite adverse social origins and expectations. Or perhaps the story is one of freedom and equality, in which you are bringing a family from an oppressive situation into a new country and new life. Maybe the drama is one in which you forge your own unique sexual, cultural, or political identity against the prejudices of others. In each case, you are putting yourself into a larger story that assumes the world would be a better place if more people were doing what you were doing. You may believe the world would be dramatically improved if everyone were free-spirited and progressive and willing to defy oppressive traditions. Or perhaps you think the world would be better off if we were standing for proven moral absolutes. In each case, the person assumes he or she is a protagonist, one of the good people, contributing to the way the world ought to be. Worldviews, however, are not private or unique. In fact, whole groups and cultures have their own preferred world story with generally accepted answers to the big questions and shared idols that heighten the drama. Leslie Stevenson's classic book, Seven Theories of Human Nature, lists influential views of human nature pioneered by prominent thinkers who influenced whole societies. Plato saw our main problem as being the physical body and its weakness. For Marx, it was unjust economic systems. For Freud, it was inner unconscious conflicts between desire and conscience. For Sartre, it was not realizing we are completely free since there are no objective values. For B.F. Skinner, it was not realizing we are completely determined by our environment. And for Conrad Lawrence, it was our innate aggression because of our evolutionary past. Each of these theories is really a story of what is wrong with us and what we can do about it. And each of these views of reality has been enormously powerful, influencing societies and fields of inquiry and work. When any one of these worldviews grips the imagination of a culture, it has a profound influence on how life is lived, even for those who do not accept that worldview. One of the main places that we personally live out the drama of our personal and social narratives is in our daily work. Our worldview places our work in the context of a history, a cause, a quest, and a set of protagonists and antagonists. And in so doing, it frames the strategy of our work at a high level. At a day-to-day level, our worldview will shape our individual interactions and decisions. As we read in the foreword, Catherine Alsdorf was given a new story, the Gospel, that was different from the dominant story of Silicon Valley, which evangelized fervently and optimistically about the power of technology to change the world for the better. The advertising executives we mentioned in the last chapter worked amid a story in which self-expression, sexual pleasure, and affluence were the meaning of life, and survival of the fittest was just the way life works. The Gospel, however, teaches that the meaning of life is to love God and love our neighbor, and that the operating principle is servanthood. These contrasts may sound at first rather high and abstract, but they became very practical when these two executives crafted messages in their advertising. The Gospel and Other Worldviews. We have said that any worldview consists of posing and answering three questions. 1. How are things supposed to be? 2. What is the main problem with things as they are? And 3. What is the solution and how can it be realized? Stevenson's book on human nature includes Christianity among its theories, but the author points out how different Christianity is from the alternatives. He observes that if God has made man for fellowship with himself, and if man has turned away and broken his relationship to God, then only God can forgive man and restore the relationship. In other words, the biblical worldview uniquely understands the nature, problem, and salvation of humankind as fundamentally relational. We were made for a relationship with God. We lost our relationship with God through sin against him, and we can be brought back into that relationship through his salvation and grace. Plato, Marx, and Freud identify some part of the created world as the main problem, and some other part of the created world as the main solution. The protagonists and antagonists of their respective world stories are played by finite things. Thus, Marxism assumes that our problems come from greedy capitalists who won't share the means of economic production with the people. The solution is a totalitarian state. Freud, on the other hand, believed that our problems come from repression of deep desires for pleasure. The villains are played by the repressive moral gatekeepers in society, like the church. The solution is the unrepressed freedom of the individual. Many people have a worldview that, to some degree, is indebted to the Greeks and Plato. They think the problem with the world rests in undisciplined, selfish people who won't submit to traditional moral values and responsibilities. The solution is a revival of religion, morality, and virtue in society. Philosopher Al Walters writes, "The great danger is to always single out some aspect of God's creation and identify it, rather than the alien intrusion of sin, as the villain. Such an error conceives of the good-evil dichotomy as intrinsic to the creation itself. Something in the good creation is identified as the source of evil. In the course of his history, this something has been variously identified as the body and its passions, Plato and much of Greek philosophy, as culture in distinction from nature, Rousseau and Romanticism, as authority figures in society and family, psychodynamic psychology, as economic forces, Marx, as technology and management, Heidegger and existentialists. As far as I can tell, the Bible is unique in its rejection of all attempts to either demonize some part of creation as the root of our problems or to idolize some part of creation as the solution. All other religions, philosophies, and worldviews, in one way or another, fall into the trap of idolatry, of failing to keep creation and fall distinct. And this trap is an ever-present danger for Christians as well. Look again at the uniqueness of Christianity. Only the Christian worldview locates the problem with the world not in any part of the world or in any particular group of people, but in sin itself, our loss of relationship with God. And it locates the solution in God's grace, our restoration of a relationship with God through the work of Christ. Sin infects us all, and so we cannot simply divide the world into the heroes and the villains. And if we did, we would certainly have to count ourselves among the latter as well as the former. Without an understanding of the gospel, we will be either naively utopian or cynically disillusioned. We will be demonizing something that isn't bad enough to explain the mess we are in, and we will be idolizing something that isn't powerful enough to get us out of it. This is, in the end, what all other worldviews do. The Christian storyline works beautifully to make sense of things and even to help us appreciate the truth embedded in stories that clearly come from another worldview. The Christian storyline, or worldview, is creation, plan, fall, problem, redemption and restoration, solution. The whole world is good. God made the world and everything in it was good. There are no intrinsically evil parts of the world. Nothing is evil in its origin. As Tolkien explained about his arch-villain in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, in the beginning even Sauron was not so. You can find this creational good in anything. The whole world is fallen. There is no aspect of the world affected by sin more or less than any other. For example, are emotion and passions untrustworthy and reason infallible? Is the physical bad and the spiritual good? Is the day-to-day world profane but religious observances good? None of these are true. But non-Christian storylines must adopt some variations of these in order to villainize and even demonize some created thing instead of sin. The whole world is going to be redeemed. Jesus is going to redeem spirit and body, reason and emotion, people and nature. There is no part of reality for which there is no hope. The gospel is the true story that God made a good world that was marred by sin and evil. But through Jesus Christ, he redeemed it at infinite cost to himself, so that someday he will return to renew all creation, end all suffering and death, and restore absolute peace, justice, and joy in the world forever. The vast implications of this gospel worldview about the character of God, the goodness of the material creation, the value of the human person, the fallenness of all people and all things, to, last in the list, the primacy of love and grace, the importance of justice and truth, the hope of redemption, affect everything, and especially our work. Here's an example. Early in his career as a school administrator, our friend Bill Kurtz started to see that this gospel storyline, what the world should be, how it had gone wrong, and the hope for the future, gave him a better vision for education in poor inner-city schools. All the individual stories of brokenness, of problems at home, of no sleep and inadequate nutrition, of gangs on the street and drugs in the building, have reinforced a culture of rebellion and hopelessness in the schools. The attitude about school for many of the kids was, why bother? He wanted to bring the hope of the gospel story into his work. Now, in the field of urban education today, there are many competing storylines about what education should be, what its main problem is, and what needs to change. As a matter of fact, education itself is often viewed as the savior for the ills of poverty and systemic injustice. Students are the subject of continuous analysis as one strategy or another is applied to their educational experience. Bill found that the gospel gave him a more comprehensive understanding of the problems facing the schools and a hope for redemption that incorporated some of the best practices of his field, but did not idolize them. His approach has been holistic, with the recognition that the gospel could actually shape the culture of a school community. In 2004, he launched a public chartered high school in Denver to serve a very diverse student population. One grade at a time, he helped create a culture of shared accountability and success in the school. Every morning, students gather, along with their teachers, for morning meeting. Morning meetings provide an opportunity for the community to celebrate success through weekly awards by giving shout-outs to one another for acts of service and living the school's values, and by sharing stories that point to a story of hope. But the brokenness is addressed as well. To help change behaviors where students fail to live the values of the community, students participate in public apologies where they hold one another accountable and support one another to live the school's core values better. If a student or teacher is late to school, they apologize to the rest of the community. He recognized the students' innate need to be known but held accountable, and created an environment where no one could be lost in the cracks. While good teachers have certainly been key, Bill attributes the school's success to its culture and their shared singular goal to get 100% of its seniors into a four-year college. The school has seen amazing success. Every single senior in the school's history has earned a four-year college acceptance. This first school has grown into a network of six top-performing schools across Denver. The Gospel and Business. The gospel worldview will have all kinds of influence, profound and mundane, strategic and tactical, on how you actually do your work. Every field of work is to some degree influenced by alternate worldviews and their attendant idols, each assigning ultimate value to some idol that doesn't fully take into consideration our sin or God's grace. The particulars of how the gospel works out in each field are endlessly rich. In fact, hundreds of people meet each month at Redeemer to discuss these very ideas within their respective fields. So, while these ideas deserve book-length treatments in their own right, let me sketch here the outlines of the gospel implications in just a few fields of work. What are some of the idols of business, for example? Money and power certainly top the list. But remember that an idol is a good thing that we make into an ultimate thing. Corporate profits and influence, stewarded wisely, are a healthy means to a good end. They are vital to creating new products to serve customers, giving an adequate return to investors for the use of their money, and paying employees well for their work. Similarly, individual compensation is an appropriate reward for one's contributions and is necessary to provide for oneself and one's family. But it is not our identity, our salvation, or even our source of security and comfort. The Christian worker or business leader who has experienced God's grace, who knows you are not your own, you were bought at a price, see 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 19 and 20, is free to honor God, love neighbors, and serve the common good through work. In fact, at Redeemer, we believe this idea is so important for life in the city that we work with entrepreneurs and offer classes to help them think through how the story of the gospel shapes their vision for their new venture. Whether it's a for-profit business, a non-profit, or an arts venture, we point each entrepreneur to a vision of serving a need in a way that reflects God's plan for the world. We find and share examples of good leaders, Christian and otherwise, who balance the interests of all the company's stakeholders, stockholders, customers, employees, suppliers, and even the surrounding community. Milton Hershey, for example, founded the Hershey Chocolate Company in 1903 with the innovation of putting milk into the chocolate bar. The company prospered, as did all the dairy farmers in the surrounding countryside. When the Depression hit and business fell apart, Hershey committed to not lay off his employees. Instead, he created his own public works projects in the town and put the employees to work building houses, an amusement park, and a hotel. Toward the end of his life, he and his wife, who were